Today, why elections in Belarus have led to days of protests across the country.
Вы знаете, я думала, что вся эта кампания меня очень сильно закалила и придала мне столько сил, что я выдержу все.
The voice you can hear belongs to Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, the main opposition leader in Belarus, who until recently was a stay-at-home mum. But after the arrest of her husband, she decided to enter the political arena.
Svetlana Tikhanovskaya!
Over the past few months, she has brought hope to thousands of people who are desperate for change in a country that for 26 years has been under the authoritarian rule of President Alexander Lukashenko. On Sunday, they took to the streets to dispute the election result, which recorded a landslide victory for the president. But protesters were met with a violent response from the police. Over the past few days, thousands have been arrested and two have died. Tikhanovskaya has now left the country after an apparent threat to her children.
Многие меня осудят, а многие возненавидят.
On Tuesday, she released this video. In it, she looks anxious and her eyes dart around the room. She says she knows many will condemn her for leaving and that she wouldn't wish this choice on anyone.
Поэтому...
She pleads, look after yourselves.
Люди, берегите себя, пожалуйста.
Not one life is worth what is happening now.
Жизнь не стоит того, что сейчас происходит.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus. Could a protest movement in Belarus bring down President Alexander Lukashenko? Hanna Lubakova, you're a journalist based in Minsk. And on Sunday night, the exit polls in Belarus's election were released, and they showed President Alexander Lukashenko had won 80% of the vote. People immediately began protesting across the country. Tell me what happened.
It was a completely peaceful protest. People just came to demand fair results of this election. Like Belarusian protesters do not demolish buildings, tear down buildings, they just gather. And then all of a sudden, more riot police came and they started dispersing people. Whenever riot police arrived, people disappeared and then they came again. But then more forces came and they started using rubber bullets and tear gas and water cannons. So many people got injured. Also, we know that police vans at least twice rammed into protesters. Human rights defenders said at some point that there was one person who died.
Oh, that's awful. What has it been like for you covering these protests?
For me as a journalist, I think there are different strategies. Like first, Ministry of Information would blame you if you don't wear your press card. But if you wear those signs, then you will be targeted as well. And we know about journalists being targeted with rubber bullets and tear gas just because they were journalists. Journalists were detained as well, and I know about my colleague who's editor-in-chief at Nasheniva. He was coming back, he was on his way to his home when he was detained, so he was probably surveilled. We just don't know what happened to him and where he is. And it actually, it's the same for many other people. Journalists disappeared. We are looking for them at detention centers, but also relatives of thousands of people, hundreds of people are looking for their brothers or parents who disappeared during this protest.
I mean, that's incredibly scary, Hannah. And you were a journalist reporting on this yourself. Were you worried about what might happen to you?
Yes, I mean, on many levels. I'm not at home now. I'm elsewhere at a safe location, which I will probably have to change. There are no rules. Like, if you report from a conflict area, you still kind of can understand where you are and where you cannot be. And here is just, you can be detained, you can be arrested, you can be beaten anywhere. And if you're a journalist, it doesn't help. One of the most outrageous examples in a way of this police brutality, people started gathering farther away from the city center in Minsk. I was also there and it was really far away, like no protest kind of happened there before. It was just, you know, in the outskirts. Protesters stayed there for a while. They were completely peaceful, nothing, they did nothing. They were clapping, cars were honking. And all of a sudden, riot police came again. So we ran away to a car. And then also stun grenades were deployed and riot police started firing at people and also at cars. So a stun grenade exploded near our car, actually, and I have it on the video.
That's terrifying. You must have been so scared.
Yes, I mean it was, yeah. On Monday evening, these stun grenades were deployed near a grocery store, a very kind of big, large grocery store, and near bus stops. I saw people who just stood at these bus stops, and they saw these stun grenades, you know, deployed nearby, just super, super close to them. And many people, women, started crying because they were shocked.
How likely do you think it is that the protests can continue? I mean, it's clearly becoming harder for people to gather on the streets or to organise after Lukashenko cut most of the internet in the country. How important do you think civil unrest will be to determining the eventual outcome of this situation in Belarus?
To me, this kind of open resistance doesn't have a chance to succeed. At the same time, I am sure, and what I saw in the past weeks and months of traveling, people are angry. People are dissatisfied with the authorities. People just want Lukashenko to go. They don't want any compromises. They're tired of compromises. They don't expect anything from him. They just want him to leave. They just want someone new. They want to change the man at the top. And they want more freedom, more democracy, and more, you know, their rights to be respected.
Andrew Roth, you're The Guardian's Moscow correspondent, and we just heard there from Hannah that people in Belarus want President Alexander Lukashenko to go. He's been in power for 26 years, but how did he become president?
This goes back to the situation in Belarus just after independence in 1991, when the country, along with Ukraine and Russia, had been part of the core group of Soviet countries that had decided to dissolve the Soviet Union.
In Moscow, the hammer and sickle is lowered for the last time.
And kind of came into this new period where Belarus had, for 80 years, basically been part of this Moscow-dominated political, economic alliance, entire way of life under the communist government. So under the country's first leader, Stanislav Shushkevich, we did see a sort of movement to reforming the country, toward charting more of a pro-Western path. And it's around this time in 1993 that Lukashenko, who was a former farm manager and sort of, you know, a political outsider to a certain degree, is amongst those who comes forward and accuses the government of mass corruption and challenges Shushkevich in 1994. And wins that election in what was probably the last free and fair election that was held in the country. He painted himself very much as a populist, you know, a man of the people, somebody who could chat with farmers, who could chat with miners, a person who was not going to focus on economic reform or on changing the country, but on bringing things back to how they were, to the people who kind of missed the Soviet Union or had nostalgia for it. And he also shows that he's not going to be dealing with any opposition inside of the country. So the kind of seminal moment when Lukashenko starts to earn this last dictator in Europe moniker is when he holds a constitutional referendum in 1996 that eliminates a lot of the other independent levers of power in the country that could oppose his presidency. And in 2004, he also eliminates term limits, which is sort of the last step to what has become pretty close to becoming a president for life. Lukashenko has managed to stay in power for 26 years, and with Sunday's election, he would return for a sixth term as president of the country.
So what has life been like for Belarusians over the past 26 years?
Well, it's changed quite remarkably, I think, over time. I think Belarus kind of managed to avoid some of the absolute extreme difficulties that took over some of the other former Soviet republics in the 1990s. And there's a reason that Lukashenko's statements about stability, about controlling the economy, preventing, let's say, prices from going out of control, making sure people get their pensions, is quite important. You know, the country did show good economic growth in the 90s and early 2000s, but it's become more of a situation of stagnation as time has gone on, particularly over the last 10 years or so. But what we've seen in every election since 2006 or since 2000, and what we've seen in the daily way that the country works, is that daily life is kind of left to be tolerable so that people don't want to get involved in politics or anything like that. That was sort of the Lukashenko trade-off, the deal that he wanted to make with his electorate. The human rights issues that have been taking place in Belarus have been there, you know, basically since the beginning of Lukashenko's rule. We've seen pretty much consecutively after every election that Belarusians go out on the streets to protest and that they're beaten and arrested. We've seen free press be cracked down on very heavily in the country, where television is basically effectively run by the government and there's very little in terms of independent television in the country as well. He's managed to do that despite sanctions from the West and despite a pretty turbulent period right now, too.
And how has the country's relationship with Russia evolved during this period?
Since Lukashenko's come to power, there was always sort of a charting towards a closer relationship with Russia. With the creation of the idea of a kind of union state in the 90s that would bring the two countries together to the point where they would have a common border, where their economies would be much more integrated. The militaries of the countries are also very closely intertwined, and so it sees it as kind of an integral part of the country's defenses. That relationship for a long time worked for Lukashenko. He was able to, or he sought to at the very least, find a balance between Russia and the West. And a big part of the way that Lukashenko has kept power is by playing the two different powers off of each other. On the one hand, if the West is kind of attacking him on his human rights record, he can run to Russia for economic support or various other things. If Putin is pressing him too much on any questions, either on the economy or on questions of integration, he can always try to seek support in the West. And so what we've seen is a seesaw in the last 10 years of Lukashenko at first in 2010 cracking down very hard on protesters, for which he was personally sanctioned by the EU and by the US, and him kind of growing much closer to Russia in that period. But then after the annexation of Crimea and the invasion of Ukraine in 2014, Lukashenko kind of moving back the other way toward the West.
And next, we turn tonight to the tension rising around the world as Russian President Vladimir Putin casts his shadow across the boundary of Europe and Russia. Tonight, his troops are holding firm in a corner of Ukraine known as Crimea. So will he push any further in as the U.S.?
Why do you think that Crimea prompted him to move towards the West?
You know, I think that he views Crimea as a very dangerous precedent for himself. He knows that there are a lot of people, including those in his base, who might want to have a closer relationship with Russia. And while Lukashenko, you know, has played on that and used that idea of a union state to kind of increase his own power, he also recognizes that in the end, it could be very dangerous for himself, an actual full alliance with Russia that would see his power dissolved as a secondary ruler. So I think that when he saw that Russia was actually willing to go into Ukraine and annex a section of the country because of the political situation there, he recognized that that's somewhere where he could be quite vulnerable in coming years. You know, the most important thing people who watch Lukashenko say is that he might be with Russia today, or he might be with, you know, the EU, or say he's closer with the US tomorrow. But the most important thing to him in the end is maintaining his power in the country.
Right. So it seems like Lukashenko is in a precarious position internationally. And you mentioned him also cracking down on a growing protest movement at home. Why has that gained so much momentum in this election?
I think the catalyst was really the coronavirus crisis.
On Saturday, the former Soviet country held its annual parade marking the end of World War II. Thousands of troops watched by 10,000 spectators. No social distancing, almost no masks.
I mean, the main thing and the main idea for him here was to show that, you know, he wasn't scared of the coronavirus. And it's this machismo, politically incorrect character that he's been playing, right? That he was just reprising essentially for the coronavirus era. He would make these kind of off-the-cuff statements that people should be out in the fields on their tractors, the tractor will heal coronavirus, saying that people should use vodka or go to the sauna or other stuff like that. I think a lot of people think that he might have misjudged just how angry people were about the epidemic when he did that. I mean, this is something we've seen not just in Belarus, but in other countries around the world, you know, the US or in Brazil. But what set Belarus apart is that it never really shut down. Belarusian football continued to be played. People continued going to church. That A, angered a lot of people, but B, it made people realize that they really had to rely on themselves. And that created a very large group of volunteers and other organizations that were basically doing things that they would have expected the government to be doing, but had decided not to. And that was like a sort of major confidence builder for a lot of people in the country who realized, if we can do this, why do we actually need this government then?
So there's this huge groundswell of discontent in the country with a government that has ruled for nearly three decades and has failed to deal with the pandemic. And out of this movement emerges Svetlana Tikhanovskaya.
And this government will never respect us because for more than 20 years it didn't.
Who is she?
She is trained as an English teacher from Belarus, a translator as well. Before the campaign, she was a stay-at-home mom by her own admission. And she's the wife of a popular YouTuber, Sergei Tikhanovsky. During the election, Sergei was at first blocked from taking part in the election, and then he was arrested by the government, and he remains in jail to this point of time. And Svetlana Tikhanovskaya at that point basically stood in as an accidental candidate, as a sort of reluctant candidate who said that she would take the place of her husband through the presidential campaign to give his supporters the possibility to come out and vote for her. As time went on, because she was this accidental candidate, all of the other candidates who were running for president against Lukashenko, who were part of the opposition, were basically pushed out of the elections. They left her in because they viewed her as a kind of weaker candidate, a technical candidate who wouldn't pose a real challenge to the government. And that's turned out to be a real mistake. In the last months, we've seen, as other people have joined her campaign and they've kind of united the opposition around her, Tikhanovskaya started to gather these larger and larger rallies around the country, from 5,000 to 10,000 people in Minsk the first time, a couple of thousand in cities, even far outside of the capital where people aren't used to protesting against the government, where Lukashenko has a lot of more support. And then finally cresting with this rally with something like 65,000 people in Minsk. So it basically got out of control for the government.
And is it unusual to have women in prominent political roles in Belarus?
Yes. I mean, the optics of this campaign are extremely unusual for Belarus. You know, politics in Belarus, particularly under Lukashenko, are incredibly male-dominated. And it was the image not just of Tikhanovskaya, but it was also two other sort of strong female politicians, Veronika Tsipkala and Maria Kolesnikova, who joined her from the other opposition campaigns. And the three of them kind of coming together and presenting a united front represented by women in this campaign was extremely unusual for the country. And it's something that Lukashenko himself noticed. He kind of put them down in some comments that he made, saying, you know, oh, she's sort of a poor woman. Women shouldn't be running the country. But it seems to have backfired throughout this campaign. And her representation of a new approach to power, just having a more feminine image of what the leadership of the country could look like, I think has been an important part of this campaign.
And what has Tikhanovskaya been campaigning on? You know, what are her policies? What are her promises to voters?
Tikhanovskaya has an extremely simple election platform. First of all, to push Lukashenko aside. Secondly, it's to release political prisoners. That would include her husband. The third is to reverse the constitutional referendum of 1996. It is seen as a kind of something like an original sin of his presidency, and something that any kind of idea of what Belarus should look like would return to before that time. And the last step would be to hold new free and fair elections within 6 months of coming into power. Getting into power long enough just to be able to set up new elections, I think, is something that makes her able to collect more people, more of an electorate around her, even those who might have slightly different ideas of who they would want in a political candidate besides her.
She is incredibly popular and many think she won this election. But what's happened to her since Sunday's results, and how does she end up in Lithuania?
Since the result on Sunday, Tsikhanouskaya has been put in sort of a difficult situation. On the one hand, she has contested the results of the election. She's come out and she said, we don't accept these results and we want to see a recount. And we think that there was a lot of vote rigging. We consider ourselves the winners of this election. But they've stopped short of actually calling people to go out onto the streets and protest. I think that they've understood that that's kind of a red line for the government. And Tsikhanouskaya has always been, you know, a slightly more reserved candidate. And this is, meanwhile, she's been put under extreme pressure after the results have been announced. During the election campaign, she sent her children abroad because she said that she'd been threatened and she was worried about their safety. Her husband, of course, is still in jail. You can kind of see the extreme strain and stress that she's been put under. And late Monday night, she left Belarus and she's fled the country for Lithuania.
Of course, I'm concerned of my safety because in our country, you can be jailed without any reason.
That was confirmed by the Lithuanian Minister of Foreign Affairs and by others.
Now she's in Lithuania, she's safe. She had not so many options, I believe, and was kind of pressure to leave the country. She now is united with her children, right?
It still isn't quite clear whether she was expelled from the country or she fled. We know that she was arrested on Monday afternoon after filing an official complaint against the elections, but exactly why she left the country isn't clear. What is clear now is that she is in Lithuania and that it's unlikely that she's going to be returning to Minsk in the near future.
After this, what happens when two candidates say they've won an election? We have two candidates here who say they won this election. Lukashenko claims he secured 80% of the votes, but the opposition say Tikhanovskaya would be the clear winner if the votes were counted fairly. Who do we believe here?
I think that it's important to keep in mind that, I mean, Lukashenko is popular among a certain part of the country, despite the failings of the government, especially an older electorate, oftentimes outside of the capital city. And also, you know, he probably earned a lot of support from people who depend on the government for their livelihood, teachers, etc., because he has a lot of control over getting them to the polls. That said, we have seen results come out of some elections commissions who have admitted that the results that they had published initially weren't actually real. And in some cases, we've seen fairly large victories for Tsikhanouskaya. So the idea that, you know, she only won 10% of the country's electorate seems extremely unlikely. Even if, you know, she wouldn't have won an outright victory in the first round, I think it's pretty likely that we could have seen a situation where it would have gone to a second round. And in that head-to-head battle, I mean, it's likely that she would have had a very strong chance of winning.
Andrew, do you think that Tikhanovskaya's popularity says more about her as a candidate or about a country that has been worn down by 26 years of the same president?
I think that you have to factor in both of those things. I think that without the degree of anger at Lukashenko right now, it would be impossible to imagine the kind of popular support that showed out for Tikhanovskaya and a lot of people defecting from supporting the president. But at the same time, I think that Tikhanovskaya is quite a special politician for the country, particularly at this time. She's a person who made it extremely clear that she wasn't interested in holding power. She's a person who would have preferred to stay out of the presidential elections in general, it seemed, but had decided to do it out of a sense of duty to her husband or her husband's supporters, and who really kind of grew into that role during the presidential campaign. I mean, you could see her change in the weeks that she was appearing before voters, giving speeches, giving interviews. And I think that she fulfilled expectations that she wanted to live up to during the elections.
What has the international response to these results been? You know, what is at stake here for Russia and for the EU?
The reactions to the elections have been, I guess you could say, mixed, but predictably mixed. Putin came out very quickly and congratulated Lukashenko with winning the elections and insisted that now is the time to get back to discussing integration between the two countries. Some countries in the EU have come out pretty strongly against the results.
Belarus and Belarusian people are partner of the European Union, and we are committed to develop this partnership with Belarusian people and with Belarus as a country. And that's why it is important to have elections as a process of democratic selection.
And it looks like there's efforts by a lot of people in Belarus and also by former members of government to get a stronger response from the EU. You know, the EU has said that they're unhappy or concerned with the kind of events that are taking place in the country, both with the elections and with the pressure on the protests. But there is a push for a return to the sanctions. We have seen some reaction from the U.S.
Look, we watched an election that we were very concerned about. It wasn't held in a way that was free and fair.
Michael Pompeo came out with a statement saying that the U.S. was concerned about the reactions to the election, concerned about the violence, and also concerned about how the elections were held. And that's also quite important because I think that the Belarusian government was hoping to see the return of a U.S. ambassador to claim that it had emerged from the isolation it had been put under.
Andrew, it feels like this situation could go one of two ways. You know, on the one hand, you've got Lukashenko, who's vowed to crush election protests. There could be a much more authoritarian response to this. On the other, you've got protesters who are still out on the streets and a popular opposition candidate, Tikhanovskaya, who is rejecting the results of the election. What do you think is going to happen?
It's so difficult to predict what exactly will happen, but I think that there are two main possibilities. The first one is that the government makes it so difficult to protest or so dangerous that the protest can't maintain a momentum, that there aren't enough people left who are willing to go out and risk their lives. But I mean, there is also a major danger in that, which is that the violence itself can become a catalyst for protest and for the situation growing out of control. If Belarusian interior ministry troops decide that they don't want to take part in this anymore, that's another real danger for the government. You know, I was speaking with one expert about Belarus during our reporting, and he said, you know, we've never seen a situation where Lukashenko has really had to be brave before. We don't know how brave he really is. We've never really seen Lukashenko put under this kind of pressure.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Andrew Roth. Read all his latest coverage and analysis of events in Belarus at theguardian.com. Thanks to him and to Hannah Lubakova. Today's episode was produced by Sam Colbert and sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Thank you for listening this week and for all your reviews. Please keep them coming as we love knowing what you think of Today in Focus. Have a lovely weekend. We'll be back on Monday.